Hello and welcome back to War Stories with B-Rex. This is B-Rex. It is October 31, 2020, Halloween. I'd like to preface this episode by saying that I have no hard feelings towards anybody that I served with. I made a mistake, sort of, by listing people's names. That's why I took down those episodes, and I'm going to be editing out people's names. I want everybody that was there, even the people that I disagreed with or had problems with at the time, I still want them to do the best that they can in life. So from now on, I won't be using names except for my close friends who basically give me permission. So I'll jump right in. So I left you guys with getting promoted with another Marine to Lance Corporal. And being told that we need to pack our stuff up because we're going to Syria. Or we're going over the Syrian border. And we were confused and were like, okay, this is kind of cool. Because we were kind of still wanting to do... we were still wanting to do the gnarliest stuff we could do. And we wanted to get a little bit of payback because at this point we had been losing tons of guys. And my company hadn't killed anybody. Echo Company, on the other hand, they had been getting a lot of kills, and there's actually a book called Angels of Anbar. If you're ever looking for a good book to read, I can't remember the author's name. Very good author. He was actually embedded with our battalion with Echo Company. And my only gripe with the book is it's a very positive book. It's very gung-ho. It's very like John Wayne war movie kind of style, you know? It's very patriotic, and I think that it kind of glazed over some of the serious bad stuff that happened. Or some of the serious stuff that happened that is neither bad or good. It's just the reality of war. But written very well, very action-packed. It's an interesting take. It's more about the company leadership side, whereas the story I'm trying to tell, at least right now, is more the junior enlisted side. So we pack up our stuff, we get on a convoy, because we did the mobile units, 5th platoon did regular resupplies and mail drops and everything up to the dam and back. Dam is where our battalion headquarters was at. So we hop on the truck, we head up there. I can't remember if we stayed the night or not. But we get on CH-53s and we fly from there to Al Asad. So we basically did the exact same trip that we did coming in, but we did it going the other way. We chill in Al Asad for a little bit and we meet this major. And I can't remember his name. The only thing I can remember about him is that he's like, call me Thumper. I think he was like some sort of a pilot or something at some point. He's like, I'm call sign Thumper. He had a shaved head. That's all I really remember how he looked. And there was about a squad of us. So Golf Company sent like two bodies. Echo sent... Every single company sent some guys. So we had about 15 guys, a squad, including a sergeant squad leader. And we had comm gear, we brought everything we needed to do a patrol over the Syrian border, and this major was in charge of us. So he starts talking about what we're going to do, and he keeps saying something along the lines of, this is going to change history, this is the biggest development in the Anbar province, to date. I mean, this is huge, what we're about to do, and so we were, like, really motivated. We get on a C-130, just one squad of Marines, and we fly and we land at a base up in northern Iraq. And we thought we were going to be closer to the border, but we landed just outside of Mosul, which Mosul's been in the news a lot last couple years because there's that huge urban battle between Iraqi forces and ISIS. But I remember getting off of the C-130, And remember, we just went from our tiny little forward operating base, or FOB, where you have to wear full gear just to run across the open to go take a piss. And we landed on an airstrip. They lowered the ramp. We come walking off the ramp, and like two civilians come driving up on one of those like trolley tram things that they have at the airport. And these dudes were just dressed with like earmuffs, like the guys that you see at like Chicago O'Hare out in the snow, like taking your bags off the planes. And they're there to pick up our bags. And all we had were our like patrol bags, like our day packs with, nothing really in them. So we like put our day packs into the little trolley cars, and the dude drove away. And we're like kind of looking at each other like, what? And this base is huge. Like, I think it's bigger than Al Asad probably. And this army guy comes up to us and starts giving us a brief on the rules of the base. You carry your weapon in condition four, like the usual stuff. But then he's like, if you have a cell phone, the delivery pizza number is da 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 1 2 3 4. And we're like looking at each other like, a cell phone? We didn't bring our cell phones, and if we did, we wouldn't have service because we're in Iraq. And he like held up his little cell phone, and we're like, delivery. And they're like, yeah, delivery pizza. You just give him your can number. And we're like, cans? What's a can? And then he said, oh, there's this restaurant on this side of the base, and there's this, and there's the rec centers over here. We're like, okay. And so the other Marine from my squad and I were obviously in a can together, and what a can was shipping containers that were split in half, so they had doors on each side of the shipping container and a wall in the middle, and they literally had like what looked like neighborhoods. So you'd like walk down the street of these cans with all these front porches, and like some people had decorated their front porches and stuff with lights and like flamingos and stuff. And it was just so surreal because we're like walking around, we're like looking at each other like, this is how Iraq is for some people. I mean, I knew that some people were, ad administrivia or whatever, but this is a little pushing it. So we drop our gear off in our can, and they're like, okay, we're gonna have a formation in the morning. Try to get some sleep, and like, if you want to go to the restaurant, go ahead. So obviously, we like ran to the pizza restaurant immediately, and it was just like they had like waitresses, like pretty attractive, like older Turkish lady was our waitress, and we were just kind of like, okay, this is just so strange. And we had pizza, and then we made our way over to, and our can had heat, which our hooch and we were just freezing all the time back at our different places that we had to go, like the TCP and K3 and stuff. But they had a heater in our room, so we cranked that up because it was a lot colder up there than it was down where we were at that time. And we headed to find the rec center. And I remember there was a group of us. I don't think it was the whole squad, but probably like, five or six of us. And we see this like circus tent. And I'm not even exaggerating when I say that this circus tent could easily fit, and it was two circus tents, but one of them could easily fit our base inside it in Hakluniya. Probably twice. It was huge. And we walk in, and it's just this huge expanse. And we look to the right, and the first thing all of us notice is there's like a human-sized chessboard with these army, and everybody's army, so we're the only Marines. And so they're in their like gravel-colored camis, and we're in our desert camis. And we walk in, and like everybody stops and just looks, and they're just staring at us with like a look of like fear and like terror. It was very strange because we weren't, especially me. I mean, at that point, I think I was 160 pounds, maybe. I was a tiny dude. And they're all just looking at us, and we're like, okay. So we start talking to the MWR people to like be allowed inside the thing, and like we had to sign in or whatever. But yeah, we're looking around, and there's a human-sized chessboard, like something out of History of the World Part 1 by Mel Brooks. And then we look, and there's like six pool tables. There's a stage in the corner where there's people having like a karaoke party. There's all these beanbags everywhere. Around the perimeter, there was just like, I don't know, 20 Xboxes and PS2 or 3, whatever was the equivalent at the time. This was 2006. And beanbags and stuff. And then there was a huge phone center, which I don't know if I've talked about this before, but we had one satellite phone for my company back in Hakulania, and it was a long-ass list to get it. And there was also three computers that we were allowed to use, but again, a long-ass list, and you could only be on there for 15 minutes. And if you looked at the list, the Fobbits, that was, we called people who never left the Fobbits, they were just signed on the list like four times in a row. So they'd get off and just hang out in the COC and then get back in line and then get back on the computer. Where we were like, if we were at the base, which I've said it before, was only basically 1 week a month, you'd get on the computer like once. And I think my parents will attest to this. I think I called my parents like twice from the FOB. And one of the times the base got attacked when I was on the phone. So I had to like say, hey, bye mom, love you. Like as there's explosions and machine guns and stuff. So there's a huge phone center and computer center. And that was pretty dope. Another thing that kept happening before I forget is we had what was called River City. So anytime someone got hit and it wasn't entirely obvious that they were going to be okay, because there was a lot of guys that got hit and just kept patrolling. I mean, there were some dudes that got three Purple Hearts in my company on that deployment. But if we ever put them on a bird and it was like questionable whether they were going to survive or not, we would instantly go on River City. And I don't know what RC stands for, or River City, or where that name comes from. If you know it, comment below or hit me up on Facebook. But it basically meant all communications were shut down. Because they figured this out very quickly. With our technology nowadays, someone gets hit, you put them on a helicopter, you get back from a patrol, you get on the computer, you write the parents. Oh my God, I'm so sorry that so-and-so got killed. And that's before the Marine Corps could have the official way that they tell you, by like a priest showing up at your house with Marines. Like talking to your parents, you know, like there's like counselors, they bring counselors and stuff. And so also it caused where they thought someone was going to live. So they said, oh, don't worry, I saved your son. He's going to be all right. And then they died in the hospital. So it gave you kind of the up and down or down and up. And, you know, it was just bad. And so we were on River City almost all the time. It was ridiculous. And people, I know they didn't mean it, but people were really pissed because they're like waiting in line, like, motherfucker better died. Oh, and I specifically remember people saying that just because they were so angry because so many people never got to talk to home. I mean, I got to call my family twice from the FOB. And there were people that never left the FOB. I was very lucky that I got selected to go on this random suicide mission, which I don't know if you're picking up on the fact that it turned out to not be a suicide mission. So back to Mosul, Iraq. And we're just looking around, and there's a tunnel to another tent, and there's a gym. A gym, the equal size tent. So the gym itself was bigger than my FOB in Hakulania, where, you know, 150 to 200 Marines lived, patrolled out of, gotten firefights. This gym was bigger than our entire base. Brand new equipment. And then you're like, because you always heard at that point, like, this war's costing us $1 million an hour or whatever. You know, it's costing us so much money. When I went to Mosul, I realized where that money was going, because it was not entirely obvious where I was, where that money was going, except for ammo and food. But then the army guys and girls kept coming up to us and being like, what are you guys doing here? With like fear in their voice. We're like, oh, we're just doing a mission. We'll be out of your guys' hair here in a little bit. And like, you're not staying, are you? It's like, no, we just said that we're leaving. And what's the problem? We're not causing any problems. So then we went back to the can, went to sleep, got up, went to breakfast chow. And this is where things, it's, I have a lot of friends that were in the army, and I think the individual soldiers who are put in crazy situations like that movie Outpost that just came out, you know, I think that there's tough guys. I just think that the army, big army as a whole, really focused on the wrong stuff in the war. It really focused on making its soldiers comfortable, making sure they had all these luxuries and stuff, whereas they should have been focusing on, like, killing the enemy or patrolling hard. So we get to the chow hall, and there we have, in front of every building at our bases, there we have what's called a clearing barrel. So there's like a 55-gallon drum filled with sand, and you always, when you're about to go inside of a building, you pull your charging handle back, which brings your bolt back so you can look in the chamber and see that there's no round, and then send it home on an empty chamber. But you're doing it into the barrel just in case when you do that, a round somehow ends up in there and goes off. And you'd be surprised at how often that happens. Well, we're waiting in line. We get to the front, and there's just like a soldier, like, stop. Let me see your weapons. And we're kind of like, okay. And we like show him our weapons. And all he was doing was making sure it was on safe. And like, we took out the clearing barrels because too many people were having NDs into them. And we all kind of looked at each other like, well, then you should probably have more clearing barrels or train your guys better at not doing that. Or, you know, but I was actually just talking to one of my friends last night. We were having a beer, and he was in the army, and he was talking about how there's a much bigger difference between the fighting army and the administration army. Whereas in the Marine Corps, even though we make fun of them and stuff, like, oh yeah, we're infantry and they're pogues is what we call them. The difference is smaller. It's significant, but it's much smaller than in the army. Like in the army, he said that they just have random people everywhere that have never even done any sort of field training or anything like that. They just go straight from boot camp to administration school or whatever, or motor T school. Whereas we send everybody to the School of Infantry for a shortened version, but it's still more than nothing. So the chow hall was legit. We had just tons of food and stuff. And this whole time, and we're still thinking that we're going to like go outside the wire, go to the border and find these Iraqi policemen who were hiding, and they had to run away to Syria to get away. So we link up with that major. We go to one of the big gates, and when I say a gate to the base, it was ridiculous. It was something from like an old, like, Roman Legion movie or like the Battle of Troy. It was this huge wall that just went as far as you could see in both directions, made out of HESCOs. But then the posts were like multiple 50 cals and an air conditioning unit. And they're just like these like 3 or 4 story like structures that were built on either side of the gate with just all these machine guns and stuff. And the terrain there was a lot different than what we were used to too. It was just flat. You could see big mountains in the distance with snow on top of them. I think up in like Kurdistan area, or I don't know exactly how far they were, but in front of us was just like a couple clicks, which is a kilometer, a couple kilometers of just flat. And so we get there, and they're like, okay, you guys are going to have to go outside the wire. And we're like, okay. And everyone, all the army dudes were like being all serious and stuff. And then all we did was step like right out in front of the gate and pat down this line of like hundreds of Iraqi policemen who had graduated the academy but had nowhere to go. So they did go to Syria, but then they came back into Iraq straight to Mosul, so that, you know, to work with us before they got captured and executed by the Mujahideen or the Al-Qaeda or whoever we were fighting. And like, so literally we flew all the way up there, and all we did was pat down these dudes. And there were just so many of them, hundreds of them. So we ended up being there for like 3 weeks because so many were showing up, and it was this huge deal, and we're patting each one down, and it just turned into babysitting. So we took shifts where we'd be at way out on the far side of the base, away from everything else, isolated, There were some old buildings. I don't know what they were. I don't know if they were government buildings or maybe a school before the war, but it was an old concrete Iraqi building, and we were just housing these Iraqi policemen there, and we had a big bonfire, and they were actually pretty like social and stuff, because at this point we all hated Sunnis and liked the Shia army because we were like, getting lit up all the time in the Sunni area, so we kind of blame them naturally, I think. But meeting these guys, they seemed, some of them were kind of like, it was like babysitting because they were literally like trying to do cartwheels over the fire pit and stuff, and we're trying to keep them from accidentally burning themselves alive and us getting in huge trouble because we're supposed to be taking care of them. But you also had a dude that showed up and he had a suitcase, and we opened the suitcase and he's got like perfect camis, combat boots, and like combat gear. And he's a little bit older than all the rest of the dudes. And we're like, are you prior military? And he's like, yes, I was a first sergeant in the Republican Guard or in the Saddam Army. And we're like, oh, okay. So then, I told the major, this guy seems a lot more disciplined than the other dudes. So I think he became like a squad leader or a leader in one of the other companies when we brought him back to 2-3. So we ended up being there for about 3 weeks, I think, 2 or 3 weeks. And this whole time, so we were also there for the Marine Corps birthday, which was kind of cool. And the cooks made us a cake that said like America's Finest on it, because we always celebrate with cake on the Marine Corps birthday, even if you're in combat, we try to. At the company back at in 2-3, they actually got kegs of beer. Everybody got one or two beers. And they were like, you guys can't patrol for 24 hours after you have this, but then they ended up sending people out almost immediately. But I mean, it's two beers. What are you gonna do? So we missed that, which sucked, but we got a cake. So another kind of drama that happened when we were up in Mosul is in the Marines, we don't salute without a cover on, and we don't salute in a combat zone, and we don't salute in a boonie cover. So those are the three times we don't salute. So if you are inside a building and you see an officer, you snap to attention, you say, "Good morning, sir," but you don't render a salute. In the army, they salute in all those situations. So they salute in PT gear, they salute when they're inside a building with no cover on, they also salute with boonie covers. And they were saluting on this base. We were in boonie covers. We didn't have our A points. We were in our boonie covers, so we're not saluting officers as we walk by. We're just like, "Good morning, sir." And this major starts fucking with us, and he's like, "I know you're supposed to fucking salute me. I'm a major." And we're like, "Oh, sorry, sir. We're not allowed to salute in our boonie covers, and we're not allowed to salute in a combat zone. We don't salute in Iraq." Dude freaks out. It's this huge deal. He goes to the fucking base commander, like a three-star general, and somehow it makes its way up the chain that these Marines are being disrespectful and all this stuff. And the base sergeant major, command sergeant major, and the general basically tell this guy to shut the fuck up. Like these are they said something along because we like got the debrief from the major. And obviously I wasn't there, so I don't know, but they were told kind of like the people at this base could learn something from those guys. Those guys are going through a tough fight and they're fucking disciplined. They're just following their rules. So leave them the fuck alone. And we all felt pretty badass after that. So we keep, like I said, it got extended a week. We finally come flying back with the Iraqis, and we get back to the company, through days of whatever. We showed up, and I was actually told that one of my good buddies from SOI and boot camp was killed, which was a bummer. Turned out to be not true, but I lived thinking that he did for like 2 months before somebody was like, "Oh no, he's fine." But he was an echo company. That's why there was some confusion. So the mobile guys kept going up and working with Echo, and they were bringing some crazy photos. They were bringing photos of dudes like dead Iraqi insurgents like strapped to the front of Humvees, piled up. They would just stack the bodies on the doorstep of the mosques and stuff. And they had all these stories about the company commander up there and how badass he was and how he just like didn't care. Like he didn't, anytime one of his Marines got killed, he just was like, do what you need to find the guy that did it and like take care of him. Whereas RCO was like the complete opposite. He was just like, oh my God, don't hurt anybody, you know? And it kind of, he just like seemed to not care if it was us getting hit. And we heard this story about how the company commander up there like ran out on a one-man patrol, like one of his squads was hit and losing guys, so he just grabbed a radio and like QRF was taking too long to mount up their vehicles, so he just ran out and met his squad and like helped kick the shit out of the bad guys. That's not how it was in my company. My company was the complete opposite. So another story that happened was we heard that we finally, our company had finally gotten its first two kills, and we were like, what? How? What happened was one of the platoons was up north in Bonny D in the Palm Groves, and they got ambushed like they always do from the other side of the river or from wherever. And then they saw, this is what I was told, they saw a boat ro rolling up the river with a guy on the motor, like a little ding, little John boat, and a dude on the front with an AK, like scanning the tree line, looking for the Marines. And so they saw him, they're hiding in the trees, they saw him coming up the river, and they, it was a guy with an M16 and a guy with a saw. They hosed them and lit the boat up, and the boat sunk into the river. Upon hearing that story, none of us believed it. We were all like, what? Like in the middle of the day, there's just a guy in the middle of the river. Because it wasn't, it's not, this isn't like Vietnam where, you know, the river's kind of like Apocalypse Now style where you can sort of be hidden if you're on the river. Like the river's in the middle of a desert, so it's not like anything's hidden. There's not, and we all just thought it was bizarre. Well, either way, the CO was happy about it and was talking about writing some personal awards for the Marines that did it. But so yeah, we were like, okay. So we go on a patrol. And this might have happened the patrol cycle before I went to Mosul, but I still think it's an important story. There was one time we were patrolling in the night, and there's a lot of little skinny alleyways and stuff because the way the city is designed. And we're in the nighttime, we're being sneaky, quiet, and someone notices that there's a dude hiding in one of those alleys. And it's like, and one of the team leaders in my squad is like, yo, come over here. Well, this dude just tackles our team leader. And it's just like, they're having like a no shit wrestling match. And he's just losing like a wrestling match. And no one's doing anything. Everyone's just standing there like, oh yeah, come on. And this is in the middle of the night. We're in a war zone. A dude was hiding in the, and so I push my way through, I take my weapon off safe, and I'm raising my rifle to shoot the dude in the side of the head, and my squad leader like grabs me, it's like no, and then we like break him up, and there's some of us that are like, bro, let's fucking take this guy in, we should have shot him, he's obviously a bad guy, you're not allowed to be out after dark. And he just beat up our freaking team leader, and so they search him, he has no weapons. But he's definitely like military age male, definitely looks like probably the dude's probably most likely a bad guy. And I don't know if it's because they were embarrassed that that team leader got like lost a wrestling match against that guy. They just like dusted him off and sent him on his way. And so some of us are like, what are we doing here? What do you guys think is going on? Where do you think we are? We're in Iraq. This is a war. Like that guy was obviously a bad guy. Like what? So that, yeah, that happened. And then, yeah, that definitely was before I went to Mosul, but I wanted to touch on that because it was just one of those things where I kept having this feeling that only a few of us were taking it seriously, what was going on, or like the magnitude, like we could all get killed, or we could accidentally kill a school bus of children. You know, there's the seriousness level was just not where I felt like it should be. In my later deployments, I think that we had a much better grasp on it. But so we go on a patrol up north, and this is actually touched on in the book that I mentioned. And he got it mostly right, and he got it as right as he could probably, but there was a little bit more drama that happened with it. So the mission was, the mission was that we were going to roll in the back of a convoy right before dusk up north, and they were just going to slow down or stop for only like 2 seconds, and we were gonna as discreetly as we could jump out of the back of the truck and get into an abandoned building or into a house. A lot of that, most of the houses were like empty. It wasn't like desolate, like deserted, but like just most of the houses where a family was they were just weren't there anymore because of the fighting, so they left. So, you know, we move into this house, and then their mission was to continue the patrol, they being the convoy. I can't remember which five unit it was, but they're like, okay, we're going to drive around and find some trouble. And the whole mission was, we're going to drive around. You guys are in a hidden location. We're going to drive around until we get ambushed, and then you guys are going to attack the ambushers. And so it's like, all right, pretty cake mission. We had our platoon commander with us. We're hiding in this, which I guess now one of my buddies, my best friend, probably Montana, he told me just very recently, like in the last couple weeks, like, oh no, that was the third time we had done that mission in a row, which if you know anything about counterinsurgency, you should never do the same patrol route or have a schedule, because then you'll just get worked. Like, they'll set up an ambush and they'll take you out. I didn't know that we had done the same mission three times in a row. This was my first time going out there because I had been in Mosul. I had just shown back up. And, so we're hiding in this building, in this house, and it's like, I wouldn't call it a duplex, but there were two houses very close together that each had their own perimeter wall, but I'd say there was probably 10 feet between the two buildings, roughly the same size, and the building next to the building that we were in was only about 90% constructed, so it didn't have windows, didn't have doors yet, but it was a big concrete building. And so we're sitting there, the sun comes up, we're hiding, and there's a massive explosion. Huge. It like rattles the house. We all think that the house just got hit with something, like a V-bit or an RPG or something. So we're all like, holy shit, what the fuck was that? And then over the radio, it's like, hey, be advised, that was a controlled det. Riveron is blowing up weapons caches they're finding in the river islands. And so controlled det means controlled detonation. When we find a big weapons cache, whether it be explosives, ammo, or guns, or any of that, we just blow it up. And so it's usually like a massive explosion. You could YouTube it, you'll find where people, you know, there's like a huge shockwave and stuff. It's pretty cool. Well, they did one in the river, so I guess I need to explain that. We were in a house that was right in the palm groves, probably 50 yards from the river. And in the river, there's a series of islands up and down it, and that was a good place to hide weapons and stuff. That's why it was against the law. Like, we told them that they will be shot if they use boats in the river. Like, they weren't allowed to use boats. That's why when those two Marines saw those guys in the boat, they killed them. Without, you know, that's what we were told to do. That's how we had to do it. Whether or not it's the right thing to do, that's a whole nother argument. But we're working with the rules we got, and we're trying to survive. So this huge explosion happens. We're like, holy shit, all right, control det. And then there's like another control det. This time they warned us, you're supposed to go control A, be advised, control det in 30 seconds. Whatever. Like, all right, cool. So then when you hear the explosion, you know what it was. You don't hit the deck and think that you're under attack. So we're sitting there. The convoy is driving around in the neighborhood in front of us. And all of a sudden, there's a like an even bigger, louder explosion. And we're like, oh, we didn't get a warning for that one. And I was the radio operator, so I always knew what was going on. I was always listening to everything that was going on in the AO. So we're sitting there, and then all of a sudden, it's like, I can't remember who the squad leader was, but he gets on the radio, and he's like, hey, we just had a Humvee just get completely destroyed. We got two KIAs and one severely wounded. And we looked out the window, and they were right in front of our building, probably two blocks away. And as I've said before, these are small blocks. These aren't like city blocks. This is like a tiny little neighborhood. And we can see them. And there was this problem with when stuff would happen. The CO, who never left the wire, as I've explained before, would just ask so many dumb questions. Like, describe the wounds to me. Like, or how many rounds have you shot? Like, I don't know, we're still shooting. Like, let us take care of this enemy or ambush before I tell you how many rounds each of us shot. Because they literally wanted to know how many rounds each person shot in a squad. Like, in the middle of the firefight. It was so idiotic. So they're asking, like, explain the wounds to us. And they're like, one of them, you know, they're explaining it, like, legs blown off, all this stuff blown off. And one of them, he says, so-and-so was decapitated. And we're listening on the radio like, fuck, those dudes got fucked up. That sucks. And we saw the Humvee leaving. Like, a truck came and picked up, and all it was an engine block and the rear axle, basically. Like, it completely disintegrated, this Humvee. And the CO is like, say that again, you know? Because he said decapitated, so we all heard it because we were so close that our signal was really clear. The base was, you know, a couple miles to the south. So he said, what? Explain that again. He's like, his head is blown off. His head is blown off. And the CO's like, hand? Which hand? Left or right? Right hand or left hand? And the guy's like, his head, he's decapitated. And the CO just was not understanding what the fuck he was trying to say. I know that the quality was probably pretty shitty, but he said the word decapitated, which you can't fucking mistake. So as they're cleaning up, and apparently the turret gunner took a while to find, because he got thrown so far that they had to jump some people's walls, and like they found him like on someone's roof or in someone's backyard. They finally found him. And we're sitting there listening to them coordinate this stuff, and they're trying to save the third guy, but he doesn't make it. He had like pretty severe wounds to his head, but we're sitting there and we hear a boat motor, and we're like, hey, everybody shut the fuck up. And we're like listening, and you hear the boat motor and you hear it stop, and we're like, dude, that might be the bad guys. So we're waiting to hear if there's an attack or something. And all of a sudden, from the building that's 10 feet away, an RPG and machine gun open up on them trying to clean up the, you know, the Humvee and the wounded Marines and body parts and stuff. And it's literally 10 feet away from us. And so we're sitting there and we're like, holy fuck, let's go get him. And that's when the lieutenant and lieutenant and the squad leaders and the senior, the guys that had been on a deployment, and also the boots that were closer with them than some of us. So there's a group of us that wanted to go next door and kill them. Like, we wanted blood. They just killed three of our guys. They killed a bunch of our friends this whole deployment. Let's go fucking kill these guys. Let's take them out. It'd be super easy. All we have to do is run around the back of the house. And when they go to get back in their little boat, we just fucking kill them when they come around, like when they come out the back door. It would have been so simple. And everyone's like, no, wait, let's see what happens. So then we get, it's like, as we're having this little mini argument, I get a call on the radio, and it's like from the QRF, that's from the 5-2 or 5-3, I can't remember who it was. We'll just say 5-3 for the rest of the story. So 5-3 calls me on the radio like, hey, they're next door to you. We can't shoot back because you're next door to them. Will you please take them out? We're pinned down. They got a machine gun in there. We don't know how many guys it is. They got machine gun and RPG. And it was also rare because it wasn't just a couple bursts. The enemy, because no fire was returned on them, they sat there and shot for a while. I mean, we're talking minutes. Minutes are rolling by as we're sitting there deliberating in the house. So then the CO gets on the radio, and he's like, "Give me your platoon commander. Or tell your, I'm ordering you guys to go next door and kill these guys." The whole time they're shooting at our guys. Well, the lieutenant and the squad leaders and all of them are like, "No, fuck that. They're not shooting at us. I'm not doing that. That's no." And they basically just pushed out. So then we all stand up like we're gonna like force our way out the door. And it turns into like, it didn't get to a shoving match, but it was like an inch in front of a shoving match. Because you had all the boots wanting to go out the door and kill these guys, even if we get killed in the process. Who gives a fuck at this point? And you had the lieutenant and all these guys disobeying a direct order from the CO, which caught me off guard because up until this point, I really liked my lieutenant. And we were like, holy fuck. And so then a group of us run upstairs. We get on the roof. We're looking and we're trying to see if we can jump across to the other roof and attack from the roof down, which is actually the best way to attack a building, is up down, like from the roof down. That's why in the movies, they like land on the roof when they're doing like super hardcore special ops type stuff. It's too far. We're like, fuck. We're like looking for a piece of wood or something that we can maybe balance across and run across. This whole time, they're still shooting at 5th Platoon, and we're like just pissed. So then we come back downstairs, and it's just like they're blocking us from leaving. And Montana just sits down and like upstairs in one of the bedrooms, he just sits down and starts like crying because it's like, why are we here? We're here to kill these guys. We're not here to just walk around and get killed. Like, if we kill these guys, we could probably make it safer for us for the rest of the deployment. You know what I'm saying? They won't freaking blow up another Humvee and kill three of our buddies. So then they stop shooting. I'm guessing they ran out of ammo. And then you hear the boat motor away. And we were fucking livid pissed, some of us. And I don't know if there was an ass chewing that happened, like why we didn't go next door. Because I was listening to the CO and I'm like, I'm telling, yes, I've told him. And I think even the lieutenant got on and maybe made some excuse about how it was too dangerous. I don't know. All I know is that it was about to be like a physical altercation with an enemy fire team size element 10 feet away from us because half the squad, the bigger guys, didn't want to fucking go next door and kill the bad guys. And it causes me so much anger when I'm thinking about this. Like my blood is boiling right now. So we head back to the base and we kind of just, yeah, we fall back into, the rotation. And so I think that's a good place to end. If you like what you're hearing, then subscribe, share this stuff. But yeah, take it easy.